Hello, this is the Conversations Politics podcast. I'm Michelle Grattan. It's been a dramatic week in Canberra for the Liberal Party with a change of Prime Minister. And today we're talking with Arthur Sinodinos, a senator who's been one of the most prominent people in the Turnbull camp. He's been out of the ministry for some time, but is expected to make a return soon. Arthur Sinodinos, why was it so vital to remove a sitting Prime Minister less than 2 years into his first term?
Michelle, thanks for the opportunity to be on the program. I think what's important here is that there was a concern rising within sections of the coalition, or certainly the Liberal Party, that we were facing a potentially insurmountable electoral obstacle next year. And in part, the concern was around whether people had stopped listening to the Liberal Party, to the government, listening to Tony, and whether those perceptions had cemented to the point where it could be difficult to turn them around before the election. I think the other issue in all of this was, as illustrated by the last few weeks, there was a feeling of drift around policy, where policy was going. We seemed to be at the mercy of events, and it wasn't clear what agenda was emerging to help us take control of events. Because in politics, if you don't dominate the national conversation, a government will very quickly be on the back foot and people start to raise doubts about its fundamental competence and direction.
When did your own loyalties shift? Was it late last year when things were starting to go bad, even before that backbench revolt in February?
Well, first and foremost, my loyalty overridingly is to the interests of the Liberal Party as a whole. Now, in the Liberal Party, the leaders always have a special place. So often that one loyalty is transposed in a loyalty to the leader. But I felt there were a series of issues which had blown up through last year, which we were still seeking to manage at the beginning of this year. We then had the fallout from the Queensland election, where people were drawing parallels between some of the way we conducted ourselves in Canberra and the way the Newman administration conducted itself in Queensland. And so a number of issues came together. So what you had is a group of backbenchers who were raising all these issues, and it sort of led to a brushfire. So it was a revolt rather than some organised leadership putsch or whatever. And it seemed the only way to get Tony to listen was to take it almost to the end point. One thing that I think set it off at the end was when Tony appeared at the press club and said, well, in terms of his leadership, he was elected by the Australian people. He was seeking to echo what he'd said about Rudd, and Rudd being torn down before he'd gone back to the people for their judgment. And he seemed to therefore downplaying, if not ignoring, the role of the party room. And of course, as Andrew Robb reminded us this week, the party room is sacrosanct. The decisions of the party room are sacrosanct. And at that stage, I thought, well, we should raise these issues. There was no challenger. So it wasn't, as I said, an organised putsch. But the fact that 39 of us were prepared to take the risk of doing this was an indication of how seriously we viewed the situation. The backbenchers then, in effect, stood back. Tony and Joe were given 6 months to rectify the situation and improve the government standing. That did not happen, particularly over the winter break. Things seemed to decline again after some initial improvement, and we found ourselves in a very difficult situation again.
Now, you were one of the first supporters to come out in this these latest developments and publicly support him. How confident were you that he had the numbers before the party room vote on Monday?
We thought before the vote that the numbers were around 55 to 57, but you know, I always like to say there's many a slip twixt cup and lip, and you can, and as you know better than anybody, Michelle, in this place, sometimes people can say they're going to vote for you when they're doing the exact opposite. But so nothing was sure until you went in the room. But the fact that the vote was ultimately 54 to 44 suggested that the homework had been done, and that was down to a group that had been around Malcolm and had been doing some work with him for a period.
A group of MPs?
Yes.
When did you know that it was actually going to be on Monday?
I can't remember precisely the time, but through the course of the day, when it was clear that Julie Bishop was prepared as deputy to go and tell Tony that she thought the numbers had shifted against him, both in the cabinet and in the party room, and that he should consider what to do about that. Once that was clear, I thought, well, I think this is on. And what was important in that regard is, given her role in Western Australia, the fact that she had come to a judgment that we should not wait until after the Canning by-election suggested that she thought the problems were serious enough that something should happen sooner rather than later. She had to be involved because, as the deputy leader, she's the second most senior person who's custodian of the corporate interest of the Liberal Party. And what I want to emphasise here, that this is about the corporate interest of the Liberal Party. It's not just about promoting one leader over another.
Now, Tony Abbott has made a point of talking about the backgrounding and leaking done against him. Is this just an inevitable part of a leadership change?
Well, with leadership challenges in the past, the media, in the old days it was mainly the newspapers, were the grateful recipients of all sorts of tip-offs and anonymous sourcing and all the rest of it. What's happened in recent years, since I came back in 2011, I've noticed the culture of politics has really changed, and the backgrounding and so on has become almost industrial scale. So it wasn't just in the run-up to challenges. There seemed to be a lot of backgrounding and leaking that went on almost as a matter of course.
And you think this is different in degree than in the past?
Yes, I do. And I was concerned also about the extent to which the leaking occurred at different levels of government, whether ministerial level, staff level and the like. Disturbing.
There's a lot of bitterness around at the moment, including against Julie Bishop and Scott Morrison in particular. Do you think this will settle quickly, or would it be hard to manage, do you feel?
I think that it will settle quickly as people get on with the job of actually governing the country and reassuring in particular holders of key seats, marginal seats, that their interests are going to be uppermost as we determine our strategy in the lead up to the next election. So I think we have to get back to business and show that it's a competent, predictable government with a sense of direction, building on undoubted successes of the first 2 years, but making sure we have an agenda in the run-up to the election and we're taking proper care, particularly of our marginal seat members.
You spoke about some of the differences in the media behaviour compared to the past. One thing that I've...
I'm not blaming the media for that necessarily.
No,
I mean, the media are there.
Talking
They're
about
part of the ecosystem. It's just, yes.
But one thing I've noticed, which I don't remember in the past, is that since the change, there's been an outpouring from some of the supporters in the media of Tony Abbott. Ray Hadley, for example, has been the most... outspoken case, I guess, of anger against the people who supported the challenge. He's particularly gone after Scott Morrison.
Yes.
This is startling.
It is. I found this highly unusual because the Liberal Party is not owned by any particular media commentators, nor should it be. And my philosophy on the media is you talk to whoever wants to talk to you. And some commentators will be more sympathetic than others, and you appreciate that. But this party is not owned by anybody. And if people feel that somehow the party has sold them out, all I can say is, well, they should join the Liberal Party and run for office, and they can have their view expressed internally.
Now, what qualities do you think Malcolm Turnbull will bring to the job? And will he be better at handling colleagues than when he was a rather fractious opposition leader and alienated quite a few people in his own ranks?
From a personal perspective, what I've always liked about Malcolm is that he's a very hopeful, optimistic sort of personality. And I think this is a time where being hopeful and optimistic about the capacity of our country and our fellow Australians to meet the challenges of the future, particularly on the economic front, is going to be very important. Because what's happening is the world of work is changing around us. Innovation, technological disruption, as Malcolm often says, disruption is our friend, is going to be increasingly undermining market structures, leading to new goods and services and processes. And I think Malcolm is someone who gets that new world of work. And the important thing is to equip our fellow Australians to meet that so we don't see it as so much a challenge as an opportunity. And I think he's got a capacity to convey that. I think he's got a good capacity, as he mentioned the other day, I think he's got a good capacity to get into the economic debate in a more thoroughgoing way. We need a return to the sort of style of Howard and Costello, Hawke and Keating, where both the Prime Minister and the Treasurer were central players in the economic debate. And when you have your two most powerful articulate spokesmen out there selling the message, but engaging in a national conversation, that's your best chance of dominating the conversation and selling the message.
And he'll be more patient with colleagues?
What I've noticed from the process of working with him, particularly recently, is I think he has reflected on what went wrong in his first stint as leader, and he realises that you're better off cultivating a team of champion, a champion team rather than a team of champions. So in other words, it's not about being the smartest person in the room. It's not about trying to show you know better than someone else. It's about harnessing the wisdom, whether it's the cabinet, the party room, the public as a whole. It doesn't mean death by consultation. It means sensible consultation, but it also means being able to debate a point without having an argument. And I think that's going to be very important in selling change to people.
A lot of criticism has centred on the Abbott office and particularly Chief of Staff Peter Credlin. Now, you were John Howard's Chief of Staff, and during that period, Peter Costello always had hopes of the leadership, even though there was never a challenge. Does that sort of leadership tension make a leader and his office jumpy?
Look, you can either treat the leadership challenge attention as a challenge or an opportunity. What John Howard did was, apart from cultivating a number of people through promotion that were potential leaders, the other thing he did was not to seek to undermine Peter Costello. In fact, if anything, he always praised him and reinforced him. And I think it's very important to have that sense of partnership at the top. Malcolm Turnbull and Julie Bishop want to be a partnership. He's consulting her extensively on the makeup of the cabinet and ministry and also his own office. So I think he wants to make it clear it's a partnership in and out of each other's office, open, accessible office, within the Prime Minister's office, making clear you have a number of senior advisers who have a capacity to make decisions, that while, yes, you respect the hierarchy within the office, you have an open, accessible office which has a number of people who can make decisions. In the Howard era, the cabinet secretary, as in those days it was a MOPS position, it was under the Members of Parliament Staff Act, was a position which reported directly to the Prime Minister. You had the Chief of Staff reporting directly to the Prime Minister. You had the head of the Prime Minister's office reporting directly to the Prime Minister. So you had this sense of collegiality and team building, if you like, within the PMO. And that was very important, I think, to his success. And whenever there was leadership tensions, as there were from time to time, as you recall so well, between Howard and Costello, the Prime Minister's office and the Treasurer's office always made sure that the work of government kept going. Because the overriding thing after 13 years in opposition was to keep the government going, whatever happened at the top.
It's always difficult, though, for a Prime Minister's office, isn't it, as you, of course, know better than anyone, to keep enough control over your ministers. I'm not talking about rivals for leadership, but I mean ministers down the line, and yet not get them into a state of resentment, feeling that you're always standing on their neck.
Two aspects to that. First of all, the selections you make at the beginning of the government or at reshuffles to get the best possible ministers in the right roles is important. And secondly, I think people respond best when they feel they're trusted to do their job. So Howard, yes, would get immersed in particular issues because they became critical issues for the government. But his philosophy was always, where possible, let people manage. And to be fair to Tony, I think his disposition on coming to government was the same.
Do you hope that policies will change under Malcolm Turnbull, or do you think that this basically has been an issue of the former Prime Minister not being able to sell the message together with his Treasurer?
I think there will be a large degree of continuity, but policies will also change. I think, for example, in the area of tax, we have to consider very carefully how broad a tax package we're prepared to promote and prosecute. And if you do that, that raises questions about what areas of the tax system you're prepared to tackle and what the trade-offs are in terms of potentially concessions you look at, whether it's in the superannuation area, what further spending cuts you might make, or what other changes you might make in the balance between direct taxation, personal income tax, for example, and indirect taxation, which includes both the state taxes and also includes the goods and services tax, which is, of course, a tax which goes to the states. Now, I don't want to preempt or preview anything there. I'm just expressing something as a backbencher I've expressed for a while, which is the broader the package you can put together, the more likely you're going to get a package which involves sufficiently attractive elements that you can get the reform up and sell it, as we did with the new tax system in 2000.
Well, without being predictive, just in your own view, do you think it would be better to go bold rather than be cautious in the tax package presented?
It would be consistent with Malcolm's approach to go bold, but I think it has to be in a context where there's genuine consultation, not to stop things happening or to put up red flags, but I think also the consultation is a process by which you persuade people of the need for change and the critical elements of change.
What about on industrial relations, where Tony Abbott's been really very, very cautious? Now, you've got the Productivity Commission report out there, which is also fairly cautious, but how much industrial relations reform do you think is necessary?
I think to some extent with industrial relations reform, we put the cart before the horse. I think what we've got to do now is look, how is the new world of work evolving? And in that context, as part of that, what is the industrial relations framework got to do to facilitate that new world of work so that it doesn't become just a debate over the role of institutions, whether it's the trade unions or others? It becomes a debate about whether the system as a whole is fit for purpose as we go forward, but always conditional, recognising that we're dealing with the labour market, on the need to have effective safety nets so you reassure people that they're not going to be just at the mercy of market forces and they're not equipped to deal with that.
Do you think the change of leadership will produce a fairly quick improvement in business confidence, or is business confidence being, or lack of confidence, being driven by other factors at the moment?
I think with business confidence, they will register what's happened clearly. I think they'll be positive about it, but then they'll wait to see what actually changes, because that's what's important. What are the outcomes? It's one thing to say we're going to do X or Y, but then you have to deliver that. But the process of delivering that means also being understanding of the needs of business and the capacity to then sell that what is good for business is potentially good for everybody else as well.
Do you think some things will be dropped off the agenda? For example, will the Indigenous referendum get less attention under the new Prime Minister than under the old one?
I think Malcolm is committed to proceeding with that whole process. But again, that is a very sensitive and delicate exercise. And I think he has to sit down and really focus on where the potential areas of agreement are and where we can advance real change. But it is a very delicate matter. So it's not one that you can just pick up the pieces from the past and just say, well, we'll do X or Y. I think he's got to understand better the implications of going down different routes. And importantly, and this is one of the issues recently with this whole recognise movement, was how do we appropriately engage Indigenous people to come to a view about what they really want out of this? Because this has got to be part of a healing process. We can't afford a situation where it becomes a divisive process in its own right.
Now, we obviously expect to see you back in the ministry before too long. Are you okay to be available now for the reshuffle that will be announced very quickly, or are your ICAC issues still to be finally settled?
Look, just on ICAC, I was not in the terms of reference. I was there as a witness rather than a person of interest. The inquiries have been held. They're over. There should be reports at some stage in the future. That keeps drifting out. But I'm confident that I can get through that process and that I can handle any political backwash from that. So I'm happy to be available for whatever.
For now. You're happy to be available now.
I'm always available, Michelle, just as I'm always available for you.
Thank you, Arthur Citadinis, for talking with us today. And that's all from our Conversations podcast. Thank you to my producer, Matt Dawson. We'll be back with another interview soon. I'm Michelle Grattan.